I think over the course of the last 12 months, we've clearly seen a withdrawal of SMEs and PLCs acquiring unconditional purchases.
Well, I think it's just about the advice. You know, you need to work with them like they're business partners. I think you need to show them that you really have their best interest.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about that in terms of how common that is as a deal term? Because it's the first time I've heard it on the podcast. Hello, my name is Alex Harrington-Griffin. I am your host of the Real Developer Podcast, powered by the awesome LandTech, creators of Land Insight and Land Fund. In this third episode, myself, my co-host, Siobhan Cook from Archco Developments, sat down with our two guests to discuss the state of play in the land market, Doris Ishak from DI Properties and Chris Georgianis from CBRE. Together, we discussed everything from the buying activity of PLCs on SME sites, the move from subject to planning to subject to reserve matters, and the rise of joint venture deals. On that note, let's get on with the show. Welcome, everyone, to the Real Developer Podcast. My name is Alex Harrington-Griffin, and this is episode 3 of series 3, powered by the awesome LandTech. We're here to get into a discussion on the current state of play in the land market, and I am joined by my co-host, Siobhan Cook, the award-winning developer, Siobhan Cook from Archco. Hello, Siobhan.
Hello, Alex. How are you?
Awesome. Excited to be here. Excited that we're all on camera as well. Today, to get into the discussion, I have drafted in two land experts and two people I think we're going to provide some amazing contributions as well to the discussion. They have to, because they are our guests as well. We have Doris Ishak from DI Properties and Chris Georgianis from CBRE. Morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good. Well, we've done our intros as well, so I think it's a great chance to flip over the paper, get stuck into some questions, and hopefully share some rounded perspective with us as well. So I'll kick off. I think what our audience would really appreciate is just to understand a bit of context of you and your teams and your activity within the land space, and just give a bit of an idea. We're now in October at the time of recording. What has been your experience of the land market so far this year? Doris, if you'd like to kick us off.
Okay. Last year was a particularly phenomenal year because obviously coming out of COVID. So we're a boutique agency. We have 9-10 people and we're expanding and we're employing staff at the moment. We do investments and developments and land deals. So we both do, you know, we're quite nimble. So when the land market is a little bit slower, we go to investments, but we last year mainly did land deals. From anything from 6 units to 700 units, wow. With planning, without planning. We've done a lot of co-living, with changing buildings and existing buildings to alternative uses. And we've been established for about 30 years.
And what has been your experience of the last 9 months? Obviously, it is a strange time. No one can say that it's been easy at all. And I think a lot of our developers, including people like Siobhan in our private conversations, have registered it. It's just really tough to get the deals that you want to get in normal circumstances. You know, it's tough anyway, but now it's particularly tough. What's been DI Properties experience?
I think we have found that there's a lot of the developers that were around last year are not around. And the ones that are around this year definitely are ready to buy. They have the funds available. They have the cash available. So I think the window shoppers, as you would say, are no longer there. We have transacted from receivership sites to sites with and without planning, as I said. The main problem is not the buyers. It's obviously the land value, and and we're finding valuations. Surveyors looking at, you know, whether we can actually achieve the price that's actually been agreed, even though we believe those are to be a realistic price.
And interesting. Okay. Chris, what is your experience from the CBRE's perspective?
Yeah, so I work at CBRE's residential land transaction team. There's 15 of us that cover London and the Southeast, specifically around residential land transactions. I'm split into the Southeast part of the business. We typically focus our area of activity on the higher value home counties areas. There's 7 of us in that part of the business. And, you know, it has been a challenging 12 months. Q4 of last year, there was very little activity in terms of exchange completions. Q1 was also quite challenging. But certainly from Q2 onwards, we began to transact deals, both exchanging and completing. Over the course of the summer, we have acted on over £60 million worth of land acquisitions. We've disposed of a similar number, and we've got around about £200 million worth of disposals we're due to exchange or complete before the end of the year. It's not to say that it hasn't been challenging getting those deals to exchange completions. We've had to be a bit more sympathetic as land agents around deal structures, around deferred payments, conditionality, reviewing of technical conditions. But in the day where we've got educated, well-informed landowners who listen to their professional advisors and can take stock of the market conditions, we are seeing transactions happen.
Good. Well, I'm sure that's a kudos to your team as well. I was privy to have a conversation yesterday with a financial director of, part-time financial director of two regional developers working in the Southeast. And what was interesting, and I won't name the PLC, but they were very close to certain parties at a major PLC who basically said that they have shut up shop. They are not buying anymore. They are not adding anything to their land bank, progressing what they have, and they want to keep their core team going, but whilst recognizing they're going to lose the ancillary secondary sort of teams, they as they call them as well. What's been both your experience in PLC activity over, say, the last 6 months versus SME activity?
Yeah, from our perspective, we traditionally have sold the majority and acted in an acquisition capacity of our sites to the PLCs. We typically deal with units of between about 100 and 500. And for that level of scale, we're typically treating with those PLCs. It's fair to say that a number of them have reduced their acquisition profiles over the past 12 months or so. Some of the larger PLCs at their year ends have confirmed that they've gone from, say, acquiring 20,000 units across the UK down to 5,000-6,000 units. That was both in 2023 financial year and looking forward to 2024. So the demand has clearly weakened. But, you know, generally speaking, when we've been to tender over the course of this summer, we have expected and received between up to about 7 to 10 offers per site, which is very comparable to perhaps, you know, the 2021 and 22 years. And we're transacting with similar level of parties that we would have done again in previous years. So, you know, for family housing schemes across the Southeast, we haven't seen too much change from the PLCs, albeit, you know, there's a lesser demand from some of them. We haven't typically in the past sold too many sites to the SMEs just because the nature of the instructions that we have. But that's something that we feel at this time of the market, there is an opportunity for those SMEs to come in and steal some of the sites which the PLCs might have otherwise looked at.
And last year, I mean, I remember sitting at a lunch with a couple of land agents saying that some of those SME sites that they would have typically, let's say a small developer would have gone for, you know, a 20 to 40 unit scheme, for example, which is quite core for a small developer, that they were seeing PLC bidding activity on those kind of sites. And Doris, I know that's the kind of realm that you've done a lot of deals in as well. Did you see any surprise bidders, maybe slightly larger than you'd normally expect?
Yeah, very much so. We have had, I think in this year, we've probably sold about 20 sites and the bid from 20 units to 150 units. And I would definitely say we've seen the larger players step in on the smaller sites, which we were quite surprised about. To be honest with you, they were very much level with the SME buyers. So,
and I suppose I'm fairly set up the question, but has that still continued this year? I know this is something that we saw quite a bit last year. Has that still continued the last 6 months?
Not as much, no.
No.
No. A lot of the transactions we've done are from overseas buyers and from the SME buyers.
Interesting. Okay.
So as an SME developer myself who specialises in unconsented sites, we've obviously made changes over the last few years with the sites that we've been purchasing. Have you found a difference in how companies are addressing consented and unconsented sites, what they're favouring, for example?
Yeah, definitely. I think over the course of the last 12 months, we've clearly seen a withdrawal of SMEs and PLCs acquiring unconditional purchases. The reason for that, I think, is the ongoing and protracted planning risks around trying to get permission on these sites, which might have previously taken 3-6 months. We're now looking at 18 to 24 months. But also, as we talked about earlier, just a lesser demand generally. So there's a preference for a conditional deal structure. So that's what we've been seeing over the last 6-12 months.
Yeah. Doris, have you been seeing the same?
Well, I think that the demand is still there for unconditional sites from my perspective. Mm-hmm. And we deal with sites from 600,000 unconditional, could be 20 for 30, 40 million. Obviously, the preference would be subject to planning, depending on the landowner's position. But then obviously with that, you can change the structure being, if they don't want to do a subject to planning, then you could do a joint venture potentially, which is a very popular at the moment, which we've just concluded two joint ventures, one on potentially a potential site for 200 units and one for a potential site of 24, 25 houses as a joint venture. So the demand is still there, but it's also finding the sites that work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've found that the lengths of time that it's been taking to get through unconsented sites, now just getting through the planning, has been so difficult. How are you structuring deals with sellers now, and how are you getting them to understand the time frame changes and committing to that, or not committing and selling unconsented but at a sensible price?
Well, I think it's just about the advice. You know, you need to work with them like they're business partners. I think you need to show them that you really have their best interest, that you will do your best for them. And it's actually bringing in the professionals, potentially giving them an example of what the site can do from either architects or planners, and really hold their hands if they don't have the experience, because some landowners obviously don't. If they're experienced landowners, then clearly you work closely together. They have their professional team. We bring in professional teams, and we work together to conclude a position that they would be happy with.
Can I ask a quick question? Obviously, joint ventures is a really, really popular phrase at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I've done some challenges with some of the developers I work with, but it is one of those things that is always easier said than done. You talked about a less informed landowner. What is the kind of handholding that you have to do with an uninformed or less informed landowner, should I say, to get them to the point where they are willing to trust their partner? And also vice versa, you've got a developer who's very experienced, does this all day long, has to then work with someone who's just stepped into the realm, may have some business experience, may have very little business experience. What's the process you have to go through to get those kind of joint venture deals done?
Okay, from my perspective, first of all, to build up the trust with the landowner, 30 years of experience, and also we have two in-house surveyors. So what we do is we bring in architects that we have, you know, we've got a panel of architects, a panel of planners, depending on location. If they're a bit nervous, we bring in the professionals so they can see it's not just us working with them saying you have to sell the site for X.
They're external to your company as well.
External, okay. Yeah. We bring in professional external planners and architects, but our surveyors are in-house. And then we provide them with enough evidence to show them the resales if the planning got 20 units, 30 units from the advice of the architects. And then we take it from there and we see what their aspirations are and their expectations. And then we prove with the professionals what the true value of the site is. And then in that whole process, you've built up trust and respect, and hopefully you get it. It does work. You actually get to a point where they're comfortable with the figure, because you're trying to ensure that they get what they want from it, and it's a saleable product.
Chris, have you seen much of that in your space? And obviously recognizing that Siobhan, you know, rightly asked about the sort of changing contract lengths, et cetera, you are building trust still. Even if you're not doing a joint venture, you've still got to try and convince these parties that it's not 6 months, no matter what a friend at the pub or the park has said to them previously about planning.
Yeah, very much so. I think, you know, 10 years or so ago, 3 to 6 months might have been a reasonable expectation of obtaining a brownfield planning permission on, you know, a site which was, you know, designated or had an allocation or an opportunity to develop. These days, when we're entering into subject to planning deals, we're allowing a minimum of 2 years. Realistically, with contractual long stops and abilities to extend with appeal decisions, etc., you know, you've got a 3-year date there. And in some instances, that's just not enough. You know, we touched on the planning issues we've got at the moment. I myself have got 6 instructions in, you know, Spelthorne, Decorum, St Albans, Bucks, which are held up by delayed plans. And all of those instructions, bar one, is actually committed. And the developer, the landowner, they're trying their best to work through the planning system, but for reasons out of their control in most instances. they're unable to do that. So I think it's about, as Doris said, educating landowners, being informed, dealing with landowners that you know will listen to their professional advisors, you know, taking every site in it on its individual basis.
I think that evidence piece is one that's come up in several of the previous series and episodes as well. But I still, I suppose, when I talk to developers about this, and Siobhan, maybe you've got a view on this, but I still feel like there's maybe a limit on how much developers are willing to show that's their IP versus just, you know, putting comparables or plans in front of people. What as a developer, do you think is, what do you think you would go into a joint venture discussion with to help build that transparency or create that sense of transparency?
Yeah, it's like Doris said, there's a lot of trust building that goes into it. And there is that fine line between obviously being transparent and building that trust and being open with the vendors to actually, like say, them being too open and giving away too much. And you know, like I say, we have margins that we work off of. And I think the problem is everyone wants to get the most out of their site. Of course they do. We completely understand that. But obviously for us, there's so many difficulties, you know, with bill costs going up and interest rates, you know, we still have to get the sites to work. So it's it's ever evolving. That changes, as we know, you know, interest rates are going up weekly, well, plateau now. But so we have to be very careful not to start a conversation and, you know, because it's ever evolving and ever moving, we kind of have to be able to keep up with the changes and make sure that the vendors are aware of the changes that are going on as we're putting the deal together. So that's probably the trickiest bit of it at the moment.
Siobhan, I know you want to talk about family housing. I'm just going to ask a quick question. I get to be the person on this podcast who asks the silly questions because I'm not a developer. I just get to host. Something you said, Chris, subject to reserve matters. We're talking about conditions.
Yes.
Okay, that's the first time I've ever heard that in a discussion around subject to planning, essentially. Because subject to planning, yes, you can get planning. But then I know there is extensive troubles at the moment from developers I speak to in actually getting some of those conditions cleared. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that in terms of how common that is as a deal term? Because it's the first time I've heard it on the podcast.
Yeah, it's not that common. I think what certainly a lot of the PLCs and the SMEs, I guess, have found over the past 2-3 years is they've bought unconditionally in rising markets, have gone back to get their reserve matters and sometimes stuck there for 6, 9, 12 months. And that's fine when the market's working as it should do in your favour. Values are going up, bill costs are plateaued. But certainly over the past 12 months in September of last year, you know, the market has not been going in that direction. And so delays on achieving reserve matters are really starting to impact viability on these schemes. So we're definitely seeing a rise of offers being made conditionally on reserve matters. Not saying necessarily we're treating on those basis, because ultimately as a landowner, you know, you try to commit an unconditional deal as much as possible. But certainly we're seeing a rise of those offers coming forward. I don't think that's going to change in the short term. But, you know, as we head into 2024 and beyond, hopefully the land market will bounce back with a resilience into the new year. With inflation levelling off, interest rates potentially dropping in Q1 of next year, it should really have a positive impact on that sales market, which is going to force the developers that should probably seen a bit less demand this year, as we've talked about earlier, really push back into the market, a bit like we saw post-COVID. And we saw a massive developer influx in terms of land acquisitions post that sort of 9-month COVID period. And so when that happens, hopefully for us as land agents, that's going to bring stability. And it's also going to mean conditionality around things like RMs and technical matters are probably going to fall away. Again, it's just this kind of function of the market demand, really.
I think it was an important point to go into as well, because it's not been discussed on the podcast so far. But Siobhan, I know you want to talk a little bit about family housing as well. So
yeah, so moving back to the schemes that are actually being delivered now. I mean, we've been fortunate enough that we specialise in sort of family housing. So we've kind of been less affected in that end of things. Obviously, whereas large developments of apartments, et cetera, have obviously been more affected. Things like the loss of Help to Buy have kind of affected that end of the market. How are you seeing it from your point of view?
Yeah, so family housing is kind of my bread and butter. I'd say 80 to 90% of the types I deal with are traditional two-story family housing schemes, edge of town. That market has been remarkably resilient, as I think we probably will see. Apartment schemes across the southeast, I can't talk about London, but you know, there has been a steady reduced demand over the past few years. I think Help to Buy, you've touched on, is a major factor, and interest rates. You know, 2-3 years ago, when interest rates were so low, there was Help to Buy ability, kind of, why wouldn't you buy a flat? But these days, I think it's just a different prospect entirely. Yeah, I think that that market has struggled. We've got build cost issues that have hit that. We've got the new fire regs, increasing sustainability requirements. So all of that is challenging the viability, which is challenging the funding, challenging the valuations that Doris mentioned. And so it's an altogether challenged market.
Yeah.
It's not to say for the right deal structures and right profiles, apartment schemes aren't, you know, tradable. We've been working with some clients who have got existing apartment schemes that have acquired them, have got planning and working whether they want to build them out or not. Looking at alternative exits, so whether that's a registered provider package deal, bring in our specialist affordable housing team, build-to-rent colleagues, co-living, student, and just trying to sort of sweat the asset as much as possible. But yeah, it's not to say it's not a challenge market.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doris, you can talk about London though.
Yes.
That is a lot of your activity as well.
Yes.
What are you seeing in terms of family houses versus apartments versus the other use class?
Well, clearly London is majority flats just because it's London, but North London and going out a bit further, we do a lot of house schemes. We have, I mean, they are definitely, as Chris says, it's the flavour because of viability on flat schemes. And flat schemes that with this double staircase, you know, the two staircases now. But the house schemes, we have just agreed something, 95 homes in North London. We've got another house scheme, 165. And there is enough buyers for house schemes. Mm. There really is. The flat schemes, I think if the price is adjusted, if they're large schemes and they've got first, second stage viability, you have the price probably now has to be adjusted and whether the vendors can adjust the price. And that's what you have to work on. I think flats are definitely saleable, but they have to come in at the right price due to build costs and obviously funding and costs of funding and stuff like that. But house schemes are definitely our flavour at the moment as well.
Okay. Well, I get to be the amateur around the table and say that I'm going to start a brigade who can go out and build duplex apartments more. So you get a sense of being in a genuine family house, but you're up in the sky at the same time. So
sounds like a very good plan.
Bring duplex apartments back as a major piece for apartment schemes. Just before we wrap up, I think one of the things we always like to do towards the end of the podcast is just have like a real conversation about the realistic buyers that are out there. And obviously, from your perspective, I understand that all sellers, all vendors are have to be coached, you know, through understanding what their price point is. But we're also aware through the things that you've mentioned already, Chris and Doris, that there is a lot of pressures. And I know from my family perspective, they own assets and there is pressures they didn't have beforehand. Who are, let's say, the most realistic sellers at the moment from your perspective, maybe considering their pressures, but also in terms of just wanting to maybe be out of their space because they don't know what the future holds for their sector as well?
Yeah, I think educated sellers are those that are going to get the deals done. That said, people with high cost of equity or high cost of debt that would need to get out of these deals are obviously going to be more pressured than those that have got owner-occupied stock, which is not burning a hole in their financial cash flow. But I think for us, we tend to deal with property company clients who are well-informed, who've got structured business plans, and are able to adapt to the ever-changing market conditions. If you think it's not the right time to sell and you're well advised yourself, long in the tooth in the industry, and your professional advisors are telling you that the offer that's put on the table is not the deal to do, then you shouldn't be doing it. But similarly, if you're able to take a slightly more market-adjusted price or a deal structure based on the table today, and that exit works for you as a business, then yeah, clearly that's the right thing to do.
Okay. Doris?
For me, obviously, I agree with Chris, it's the educated sellers who have experience in the marketplace, but we're also dealing with a lot of receivers. We've sold a lot of receivership stock this year, last year, so they definitely are ready to sell. If you can't achieve the price, you know, at the end of the day, they have to work on where the marketplace is. So the educated developers we've got, they have to take a view. Either they have to sell it now or they landlock it or they build it. They're clearly coming to us because they used to build the sites. Some of the developers we've got, they would never sold any of the sites that we've got under offer at the moment. And the reason is obviously build costs, et cetera, et cetera. So we've taken, they've come to us to sell and they have to be realistic, and they are realistic about the resales and the GDV, the costs of build, et cetera. And therefore we get it on a sort of realistic level to sell. And then the receivers obviously go to the panel of their agents. They get a realistic value and they put it on for a realistic value.
Interesting. And there's so much, Doris and Chris, that we could unpack within that as well. But that is all we have time for in this episode. I think Doris, just to finish up, you know, one thing you said there is you recognizing that whilst as a vendor, as a seller, you want to pick the best agent to represent your stock. But also, I think it kind of also brings up the question or the idea of buying through the right agent, someone you know who's educated the vendor well and also can guide them through the process, you know, not necessarily just try and negotiate the best price, but also to make sure that you're actually not wasting time with someone who's misinformed as well. So, yeah.
Can I say something on that?
I'm gonna make time for it, Doris, yes.
You're very kind. Thank you. I don't think there's one opportunity we put out to the market unless we're fully informed. We have to know as much as a buyer has to know. We have to, we make sure that the local agents have informed us. We make sure on the comparables, we make sure on the data room that every document we say is in there is in there, and we understand everything that's put in the data room. So we look at the sale of a site like a purchaser would. So we hopefully have been provided with everything. So therefore it's really important, as you said, to be fully informed, because especially in this market, because you don't want anything to come up in the legals that you should have asked for when you were selling the site.
And Doris, that's exactly why we invited you onto the show. To my co-host Siobhan, thank you very much. Doris and Chris, thank you for joining us
today.
Thank
you.
Thanks, guys.
Hello, everyone. It's your host, Alex Harrington Griffin, again, just to say thank you for joining us for this episode. If you liked it, hit the like button, subscribe, and of course, share it with your peers. A big thank you to our partners, Land Tech, for powering this episode. If you want to find out more about their products like Land Insight or Land Fund, go to land.tech or follow Land Tech on LinkedIn for SME developer updates, finance updates, and of course, the data and research mentioned in this episode. We'll see you back for the next session when we get into some real development conversation. Thank you.